Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
It's a question that keeps business leaders up at night. How do you go from thinking about change to actually making it happen?
How do I start? Where do I start? What is the use case? Where's the value?
From the AI revolution.
This is the most amazing time ever. And developments in AI are super, super quickly changing.
To the urgent need for sustainability and resilience.
The physical climate risk predicted in the climate models has arrived.
The way we do business is transforming fast, but we're here to help. I'm Chip Kleinexel, host of Resilient Edge, a new business vitality podcast paid and presented by Deloitte and produced by BBC Storyworks Commercial Productions. It's a guide to implementing and sustaining change at scale. Coming soon, everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Hi there, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, is China's troubled economy entering a deflationary spiral? What is a deflationary spiral? And should we fear the worst? The iPhone 16, the latest smartphone from Apple, has just been unveiled. Is it worth the $1,000 or more that we're likely to have to pay for it? And as global prices rise everywhere for chocolate goods, Ivory Coast struggling cocoa growers complain of the lack of chocolate eaters back home.
There are some small chocolate production units, but they tend to have little contracts with pharmacies, universities and small shops because Ivorians don't have this culture of consuming chocolate.
More from Ivory Coast later in the show. First, though, the European Commission has published a report today. It calls for 800 billion euros worth of investment to drag the bloc out of industrial stagnation. The former Italian premier and former ECB chief, Mario Draghi, has written this report, calling grandly for what he calls a new industrial strategy for Europe. He spoke to the press at the report's launch.
We have to understand we are becoming ever smaller relative to the challenges we face. For the first time since the Cold War, we must genuinely fear for our self-preservation. And the reason for a unified response had never been so compelling.
Well, the risks that Mario Draghi's identifying there are very much in relation to other trading blocs, the US, India, and perhaps most topically of all, China, of course. The EU has been fending off of late what it sees as the dumping of discounted products, such as electric vehicles and other technology within the EU. I've been speaking to Finbar Birmingham about all of this. He is the Brussels correspondent of the South China Morning Post.
In a nutshell, I think there were two parts to it. He pointed out the many, many problems with the European Union's industrial productivity. And then he went into detail about what it would take to fix that. And it's going to take a lot of money. It's going to take a total shift in mindset to close the gap with the United States and China on innovation. And really, it was a damning indictment of policymaking in Europe, of industrial inertia. You know, it was like a cattle prod, I thought, to jolt Brussels out of its post-summer rent race slumber. Because if you don't act now, it's going to be too late.
Yeah, he was pretty dour, wasn't he?
It was a bit of levity, but yeah.
We were going to have to scale back some, if not all, of our ambitions. This is an existential challenge, he said.
He was saying that if we want to be able to maintain what we keep describing as the European way of life, you know, these values that we hold dear, prosperity, equity, freedom, you have to act now. You know, the era of free and open trade and being able to sort of rest on your laurels and expect things will continue is gone. It's replaced by an era of hard-nosed economic security and that dirty word in Brussels, industrial policy. He's calling for a return of industrial policy with a vengeance.
Right, because in the old era of globalization, we didn't need an industrial policy because it was all about free markets. Now we don't have those. And I guess there is a very clear eye, not just on the US, but on China especially, isn't there? Because they are accused of, well, having too much of industrial policy, frankly, from an EU perspective. They're subsidizing so many sectors that Europe can't compete. That is the view.
Absolutely. It is seen that the Chinese have not been playing fair. But at this point, the message from Draghi is, well, if nobody else is playing by the rules, why should we? You know, he's saying we need to fight dirty here. We need to throw 800 billion euros a year in investment, more than double the size of the Marshall Plan relative to the economic size at that point. And he was asked, actually, is it do or die? That was one of the questions at the press conference. And he said, not really. It's more like slow agony if you don't act now. It's going to be a slow, painful death if Europe doesn't snap out of this this slumber that it's been in for years now.
I'm wondering what the reaction has been. I mean, I saw one unnamed diplomat speaking to the Financial Times saying this level of investment, frankly, it's a non-starter in the current climate.
I think there's scepticism as to how possible it is. Hours after Draghi presented this, you had the German finance minister, Christian Lindner, rather, coming out and saying, I'm very sceptical. You know, that they're obviously, he's from the Free Democrats, and any sense of common borrowing is anathema to those people. He's describing Germany paying for other people's prosperity. And, you know, so when you've got a part of the coalition government in Germany saying this, the French government's in disarray. How does Europe learn to move quickly when its most powerful members are in absolute political turmoil? You know, in a way, it couldn't have happened at a worse time, this report, but my sense is that Ursula von der Leyen and the European Commission will attempt to move into the void. They will try and take leadership on these issues, and von der Leyen confirmed today that this will inform a lot of the policy making over the next 5 years.
Europe has been depending, hasn't it, on German exports and perhaps the Dutch and the Finns and a few other smaller countries, but so much of that high-end export revenue to make Europe a competitive player in this global market. And that's not been thriving recently.
We're hearing these words more often, Ed. China shock 2.0. The first China shock was when China joined the WTO and its imports and outsourcing from the United States, rather, led to a death of manufacturing sectors in America. What we're starting to see now is Chinese exports coming to Europe and competing with German exports in Europe and in third markets and in China. So we're seeing this model of getting rich by exporting to China is starting to fade. And it's only a few car companies that are really still hanging on to this. If you speak to any of the Mittelstand companies in China, they're really struggling. So I think you're right. This is a wake up call, but it's more like, you know, when you turn off your alarm, you put it on snooze for about four or five times. I think we're on about the sixth ring of the alarm now. And really somebody needs to take action.
Finn Barr-Birmingham there, the Brussels correspondent of the South China Morning Post. Well, let's stick with China. While Europe is fretting about losing its competitiveness, the fears in Beijing are a little different. Could it be entering a dangerous deflationary spiral, they're wondering. So asked one headline today after a new data showed that China's industrial producer prices had fallen by nearly 2% over the last 12 months. And like rising prices, falling prices do have a nasty habit of becoming entrenched in an economy. Just ask Japanese policymakers about that. I've been speaking about all of this with George Magnus. He's a veteran economist and a China watcher at the China Centre of Oxford University.
There was a very important party meeting that took place in July that went by the name of the Third Plenum. So there are seven big party meetings like this every 5 years. And the Third Plenum is usually the most important, often is the sort of the forum for thinking about sort of big picture economic strategy. So a lot of people were kind of optimistic that there would be a big breakthrough in Chinese economic thinking about policy to try to address some of its current issues. But nothing really of great consequence was said or written down in documents associated with that meeting. Although it should be said that the first Politburo meeting that happened after that meeting, so that would have been around the third week in July, did say that they felt the need to take action to boost consumer demand and, you know, a lot of kind of motherhood and apple pie kind of promises or intentions to do something to make amends, as it were, for some of the things that have gone wrong. But we've heard these things time and time again. And, you know, here we are in September and nothing's actually happened as yet, which doesn't mean to say that it won't, but it probably won't be the right thing. You know, they'll probably, you know, cut interest rates or cut the reserve requirements on banks, maybe ease a little bit of borrowing authority for local governments. But these aren't really the kinds of things that I think the international community is looking for if China were to really try to address its weak household sector.
Yeah. And I mean, there are probably a couple of answers to what it should do. But you've said in the past, haven't you, there's a kind of philosophical impasse here, one that Xi Jinping and the leadership in Beijing can't cross over when it comes to addressing this problem. They're not willing to basically re-energize the middle class by giving tons of handouts and then and raising wages, and they're not really willing as well to liberalize the economy or face perhaps the pain of a real recession to kind of clear out the dead wood.
Yeah, no, I don't think they're willing to do those things. And I think the main message that came out of this important meeting that took place in July, I think, was to basically confirm the direction of travel, which we already knew, which is that the government's solution, quote unquote, to its current problems is to really produce more, export more, and allocate state lending, basically, towards advanced technology industries like electric vehicles, solar, wind, artificial intelligence, and so on. This is really where this is the way in which Xi Jinping sees China overcoming its problems by becoming dominant in what he calls the fourth industrial revolution. There's not to say that there isn't a case for doing that, but it's not going to solve China's big macroeconomic issues.
A pessimistic view there from George Magnus here on World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Right, well, Apple iPhone fans everywhere, the big day is upon us. It is time for the iPhone 16.
Good morning. Welcome to Apple Park. Today we're going to talk about Apple Watch, AirPods, and iPhone, and the profound impact these products are making in our lives.
That's Tim Cook announcing the launch of the latest iPhone in California just a few hours ago. Yes, the 16th edition of the original smartphone may sound like a big deal, but the truth is actually that Apple's sales of its famous handset have not been stellar of late. Cheaper and some say equally smart rivals are making their claims on consumer attention these days. So how has Apple, one of the world's biggest firms, responded? Lily Jamalia, the BBC's tech correspondent, joins us live now from San Francisco. Hi, Lily. What's it like, this new phone? Were you impressed?
Was I impressed? Great question. Well, you know, it's not for me to be impressed. It's for the consumer to be impressed. And this new iPhone, the iPhone 16, is really all about the software. A little bit of a departure for a hardware product, but this product includes a suite of artificial intelligence capabilities that are built into the phone. This is a line of phones that CEO Tim Cook says was specifically designed with artificial intelligence in mind. And the company's referring to this software as Apple Intelligence. There's been some criticism that Apple has been a little bit behind the eight ball in terms of, you know, really staking its claim in AI here in Silicon Valley. Everybody's trying to get in on that. And so here we see Apple taking its time a little bit, but hoping that it will do AI better than anybody else and especially target it for the consumer. So back in June, we heard a little bit from Apple executives talking about Apple Intelligence at the Worldwide Developers Conference. And here we see the details and how it's going to integrate with the phone.
Okay. Yeah, as you say, Google, Meta, Microsoft and others have all been diving in heavily into AI. Of course, Apple perhaps slow, some would argue, to keep up. But isn't the point here that all of this Apple Intelligence, I mean, now this is about employing AI to edit images, right, to translate text, right, to create personal emojis, if you want to create personal emojis. And but it all of that actually didn't even get unveiled today. We're going to have to wait another few weeks for that.
That's right. These features are going to be sort of unveiled over the coming weeks and months with different timetables in different locations. But, you know, what will this look like for the consumer? I think, you know, you mentioned a couple of the features. You know, it's nothing earth-shattering right off the bat. I mean, creating an emoji is fun, but not necessarily a must for people, especially, you know, in a professional environment. But there are things that people can be using in an enterprise context, proofreading, having the AI proofread text, changing the tone of an email from maybe something very serious to a bit cheerier, depending on who it's for. And, you know, it's also about sort of creating more productivity for people, helping them prioritize messages and notes and things like that. You know, and also Apple is very focused on selling itself as being committed to privacy. And that's something I also found notable today was this emphasis on privacy that, you know, we heard from an Apple senior vice president saying your data is never stored or shared with Apple. And a lot of this functionality is happening on the iPhone itself. For more complicated tasks, it will be sent to a data center and it will sort of integrate ChatGPT functions. But that's a really key thing. And they even mentioned that independent experts are going to be continuously sort of keeping tabs on Apple to verify this promise that they're making to consumers.
Okay. Well, we will await, I guess, the unveiling of all of the rest of the AI stuff and the details on that. How much is it going to cost? Briefly, do we know? Did they say?
Yeah, the iPhone 16 will start at $799, so a little bit more than about £600. You've got the iPhone 16, the okay. iPhone 16 Pro, and the Pro Max.
All right. We will keep an eye out for that when it launches next month. Thank you very much, Lily Jamali there in San Francisco. Now, joining us now, our regular markets guest, Peter Jankowskis of Arbor Financial Services. Hi, Peter. How have the markets been reacting to the iPhone launch?
Well, the initial reaction was a little bit negative. The stock declined about 1% while the phone was being announced, but it did rally back. And it finished the day basically unchanged. So it did trail the overall market a little bit. So I think investors are going to wait and see how sales actually develop.
I mean, I think just a brief point as a footnote to this, these launches, they aren't what they once were, are they? I mean, they're all about AI and complicated software and not about some latest gadget because all of these phones start to look similar to people.
I think so. Given that they are so feature rich these days, it's really hard to develop a new feature that stands out from the crowd.
Yeah. Okay. There are ongoing arguments, of course, about Apple's control of its ecosystem from regulators. There have been for ages. We're getting more, aren't we? The second antitrust trial pitted against Google. It's begun on September the 9th, well, in the last few hours. Whether the tech giant illegally monopolized the digital advertising industry.
Yeah, that seemed to have quite an impact on Google. Google was down more than 1.5% today. I think also when you know put that on top of the fact that they were found basically guilty last month for the search side of things, and we're still waiting to see what sort of remedies the judge is going to put forth on that case.
Broadly, though, not such a bad day for other shares. Tell us what's happened across the market.
Yeah, there was a nice rebound. We did have a substantial sell-off in stocks here in the U.S. last week. The overall market was down about 4%. Today, it jumped back about 1%, and it was a recovery in many of the economically sensitive sectors and interest-sensitive sectors that drove the market higher. As much as we've been talking about Apple and Google, in terms of consumer discretionary stocks were up strongly, technology stocks were up strongly, all just waiting to see what the Federal Reserve is going to do next week with interest rates.
Yeah, optimism, I guess, that we're going to see a rate cut, and that's where all eyes, of course, are focused. Thanks very much, Peter Jankowskis of Arbor Financial Services there. Thanks for your time. Now, you may have noticed your favorite chocolate bar, if you have a favorite chocolate bar, has got smaller. It's probably got more expensive, too, of late. So-called shrinkflation, they call it. The price of the vital ingredient cocoa has more than trebled on international markets over the last couple of years. And that's partly because of speculation, but it's also because of other problems which affect cocoa growers in countries like the Ivory Coast. John Murphy has been there to find out more about this.
So that's the sound of two young men sitting on wooden seats getting through a pile of cocoa beans. They spike them with their machetes, cut them open and scoop out the seeds that are inside, which are white in colour. But the actual cocoa pods are yellows and greens and oranges and reds, and it's quite a pile.
It's the first stage in a long journey towards transforming these beans into many people's favourite confectionery, chocolate. Ivory Coast produces about 45% of the world's cocoa, and up to 80% of Ivorian farmers depend on it for their income.
Oh, gosh, here's the trees right here. I can see with some green pods on them. So the cocoa trees are literally mixed in with other trees.
Cocoa trees need other taller shadowing trees to protect them from the elements. Our guide through this plantation is Imi Kui, president of the local cooperative.
And what he's explaining here is that these are all small family farms. They're not industrial processes at all. It's very small scale, pretty poor, obviously, and they're producing all this cocoa.
In Ivory Coast, the price farmers get for their cocoa is fixed by the authorities to smooth over price fluctuations. This April, it was increased by 50% after the huge increases on the international market. Now farmers are supposed to get about £1.90 per kilogram of dried, brown, fermented cocoa. Many say it's not enough.
The cocoa work is hard, so I do my homework.
She does all the work by herself.
By herself, yeah.
And she's explaining that she's having to clear the branches away. Yeah.
62-year-old Marie-Claude Alibé walks with a bad limp. She says cocoa used to do well, but now the land is tired and there's disease affecting the trees.
So she's showing me a hole in the tree with some goo coming out of it. And the whole half of the trunk is sort of wet looking. She says there's an animal and this will kill the tree. And if you don't have the money to sort this out, that's it for the tree.
There's no culture for chocolate here. We don't have the culture of eating it.
Dr. Christian Cadio is from the University of San Pedro, a port city which is the world's busiest in terms of cocoa exports. The Ivorian government wants to transform the country's cocoa industry, she says, and not just export the raw material.
There are some small chocolate production units, but they tend to have little contracts with pharmacies, universities and small shops because Ivorians don't have this culture of consuming chocolate.
The point is to try to add value and not see it all go abroad. There's clearly some wealth in the cocoa business. I asked Abel Gallo, the president of a local NGO, ID Cocoa, who's making the money.
Yeah, those get money are the exporters and the chocolateries, chocolate makers and the government.
Whereas he says growers face the challenges of climate change, aging trees and disease.
Bonjour. Wow, first impression is the smell.
Yeah.
Smell of chocolate, eh?
Yeah.
Back in the commercial capital, Abidjan, we're in Chocovi, one of Côte d'Ivoire's few chocolate makers.
Oh, a bowl of chocolate has been brought out. Nature, natural. Cassava, yeah. 95% cocoa, this one.
Vivienne Kwame set up her small company 3 years ago. She caters for a middle-class market, expatriates like diplomats, and makes chocolate gifts for companies.
She said that running toward the brown gold, we committed a lot of mistakes.
Brown gold, as it was known, yeah.
Yeah, and we made a lot of mistakes. But now we are working to improve things, including fair trade and preventing deforestation. So I think now we should be more positive and not being too much critical about it.
There is definitely some value to be extracted from Ivory Coast's brown gold. The question is who gets it and whether those who actually grow it can benefit.
And you can hear more from John Murphy in his report in Ivory Coast in this week's edition of Assignment here on the BBC World Service. The French fashion house Givenchy has a new creative director. British fashion designer Sarah Burton has taken the role. Founded in 1952, Givenchy, known for its long association with movie stars like Audrey Hepburn, has been without a creative director ever since the start of the year. That was when Matthew Williams departed the role. I'm joined now by Hannah Rogers. She's the assistant fashion editor at the Times newspaper. Hi, Hannah.
Hello.
Briefly, just tell us who Sarah Burton is.
Sarah Burton is the British designer who essentially has been the caretaker of Alexander McQueen, a very famous British fashion brand, since that designer's untimely death in 2010. She was his protege at McQueen, and she has been creative director for the past 13 years. She's been there a total of 26 years. And so you can imagine why, when she announced her departure from the brand last September, every fashion editor and every one of her famous clients wanted to know what she would be doing next. And today they finally got their answer.
A pretty good job. I mean, I think it's fair to say, in the firmament of fashion jobs, to become creative director at Givenchy. Just explain to us, Givenchy is part of the LVMH luxury conglomerate, right? Which has Dior as part of its stable. I mean, is that the biggest in the world of the luxury brands, the luxury conglomerates?
I mean, LVMH is the most important luxury conglomerate. It was also the original luxury conglomerate. Other famous conglomerates such as Kering, for example, which has Gucci and which also has McQueen in its stable, that came after LVMH. It was Bernard Arnault who set up LVMH, and as well as obviously Louis Vuitton and Dior. He also has brands, really big, successful brands like Celine, like Loewe, and like Givenchy. It has a total of 18 fashion and leather goods brands in its stable, as well as lots of other sectors. So, you know, it is this huge machine, and Givenchy actually has been kind of playing second fiddle to other brands like Celine, certainly second fiddle to Louis Vuitton, to Dior, yeah, which are these, you know, gigantic Goliath brands that really are the sort of jewels in the LVMH crown. But I suspect that they will be hoping that Burton could shift the order around, because historically Givenchy is a really important fashion house.
Right. Just in a word, the high-end fashion market, how is it doing right now? I mean, is it suffering? We started talking about China in this programme. Is China, the fall of China, or is decline causing fashion to suffer?
Yeah, absolutely. The luxury goods market is slowing down. Even LVMH, the beast that it is, has eked out pretty minor growth figures in recent quarters. And there is a slowdown in demand from not only Chinese clients, but from US clients.
Okay.
Now, obviously, the issue with the
slowdown. We'll have to leave it there. Sarah Burton, thank you very much. Thank you very much. That's the end of the...
That world has eaten up and spit out a lot of young and attractive guys.
The stories they don't want told.
This person is not who you think he is.
World of Secrets is the BBC podcast that brings you major global investigations and gripping storytelling. Season 1, The Abercrombie Guys. Season 2, The Disciples. And Season 3, The Apartheid Killer, are available to download and binge in full, with more investigations coming very soon.
The culture of secrecy need to be broken.
Search for World of Secrets, the Global Investigations podcast from the BBC.